Coming up on Weekend America.
40 years ago this weekend, a president redrew the political map.
What Richard Nixon did was to create a language to make people feel that they could vote for Republicans and not be snobs.
Nixon's silent center speech and why it matters today. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, what makes a great war movie?
In the case of Patton, the opening sequence, you always think of it, it is parodied, it is made fun of, but it truly captures the American people, that they love a winner, will not tolerate a loser.
We'll visit this weekend's GI Film Festival in Washington, D.C., and from war on the screen to war in the ring.
If you get a man in there that's going to do anything he can to win, and he'll choke you or kick you or bite you or anything, the people are going to like him.
Cable TV wounded it, but in St. Louis, old-time wrestling will not lose. That's Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. This weekend, people are at the Preakness to see if Derby winner Big Brown will also grab the second jewel of the Triple Crown. And in nearby Washington, D.C., folks are gathering for the second annual GI Film Festival. Now, you wouldn't think America would have a taste for war on the silver screen, with it playing out for real in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we'll talk to an expert about America's appetite for war films. Now, with a lot of stark news in the headlines lately, how about a little good news? What's the best news you've gotten this week?
Oh, you know what? The best news that I have right now is my family's in town. We're getting together after 3 years.
My son got his first haircut. I did it for free since it was his first haircut. Oh, my goodness. He was trying to jump out my arm.
My coworker had a kid. Baby Arnold. I don't know her first name.
I might have a rental place that comes equipped with a roommate.
Probably that my good friend is moving into town.
The best news that I heard this week is that Knight Rider is coming back to television this winter.
Yes, all the automobile you loved with none of the Hasselhoff.
Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Washington, D.C., and Chicago.
Welcome to the radio show about the American weekend.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
We hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
We're bringing you an ongoing series called This Weekend in 1968, because so much happened 40 years ago that still shapes our lives today. Last weekend, we observed the anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign. This was an attempt to make poverty more visible, so Americans turned on their TVs and saw people demanding economic justice. They saw clashes between citizens and police. It's no surprise, then, that the following week brought a famous appeal for calm. This weekend in 1968, presidential candidate Richard Nixon gave a radio address that became a pivotal moment in American politics. Nixon emphasized that most Americans did not stage political protests or riots, and he tried to make himself the candidate for these Americans. Here's Nixon biographer Rick Perlstein.
You know, imagine what it was like to be kind of a white suburban family in the 1960s and see all this chaos kind of break out on your TV screens, riots in city after city, blacks burning down their neighborhoods, students burning down their universities. The media was giving so much attention to these clamoring voices, clamoring for social change, clamoring for social justice.
But if you are revolutionaries, you must assume the revolutionary posture.
And there was just a lot of anger and resentment building up over that. By 1968, the federal government comes out with a report, the Kerner Commission report, which described the reasons for the riots. And the preface of that report was very famous. It said, white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it. White institutions maintain it. And white society condones it. So this idea that ordinary middle American white people were being blamed for all these problems was something that people were very sensitive to and not many politicians were speaking to. Right after the Kerner Commission report, Richard Nixon got a very interesting memo.
April 27th, 1968. concerning the real issue in the cities.
From a young aide named Richard Whalen.
In my memo to Nixon, I suggest that a neglected social frontier exists. It is where the doors must be opened and the people prepared for the next great phase of the American experiment. It is suburbia.
The next president of the United States, Richard M. Nixon.
I'm Richard Whalen. In 1966 through 68, I was one of the small group of men around Nixon who wrote his speeches.
And my friends, I say to you tonight,
gave him a steady stream of memos, ideas, phrases.
Let's be for something on November the 5th. Join me in that time.
At that point, there were three of us writing speeches. Ray Price was a very graceful liberal Republican. Pat Buchanan, who was a somewhat more pugnacious, very conservative Republican. And me, who was a sort of a moderate conservative centrist. Nixon referred to us as his bright young men. When we were 33, we knew everything. Now that I'm 72, I'm almost 73, I don't think I know anything. But I never met a more confident group of people. And the young people who organized around this veteran, battered loser and made him president.
I think I get a message from your welcome. We're going to win.
Nixon was in the middle of a primary fight, getting ready for the Republican convention that summer against a much more liberal candidate, Nelson Rockefeller, on his left, and Ronald Reagan to his right. There was another candidate in the 1968 presidential election, George Wallace, who was the segregationist from Alabama.
Now let's talk about law and order a moment.
And George Wallace was threatening a kind of authoritarian law and order, tell the police to shoot on sight.
Oh, yeah, good haircut would help you. I think that's all your problem. Good barber could cure you.
Wallace was the voice of the aggrieved, almost panicky white middle class threatened by black urban violence. We were trying very hard to establish Nixon as the center, as the man who could calm the racial storm and establish order without being a bully or an authoritarian.
Nixon's the one.
The one. Nixon's the one was our slogan. Not that I liked it, but it was the slogan.
What has to be done by president and people together, or it won't be done at all.
The writers kind of hung out together, and we would argue as though Nixon were a man who had a definite thirst for whiskey, and we were the bootleggers. We'd argue what sort of good should we put on his doorstep, and would he like it? Nixon liked phrases. He would tell us, look for that line that you can lift a speech with.
Together we can hardly fail, for there is no force on earth to match the will and spirit of the people of America.
The lift of a driving dream, stuff like that. And I hate to say it, but writers read other writers. And in 1948, I believe, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. wrote an important book called The Vital Center. A marvelous title. So, 20 years later, we picked it up, guilty as charged.
Good evening, my fellow Americans.
Nixon went on the radio in the spring of 1968 and decided basically to answer the people who felt like the liberals were claiming that it was their fault that America was going to pot.
And the vital center becomes
the silent center, the millions of people in the middle of the American
political. The audiences who listened to him were silent.
Who do not demonstrate, who do not picket or protest loudly.
These were people who were not ever going to demonstrate anywhere, who were not ever going to riot, white or black. But they were people whose weight at the center of the political spectrum could tip to the left or to the right.
Imagine if Richard Nixon's soothing voice comes on the radio and says,
a great many quiet Americans have become committed to answers to social problems that preserve personal freedom.
All you people who feel humiliated, who feel talked down to by the liberals, who feel like the world is exploding around you and you're getting blamed for it instead of the people who are rioting, You actually comprise a political constituency.
And as this silent center has become a part of the new alignment, it has transformed it from a minority into a majority.
Political speech is not very different from poetry. And often it can just be the resonances of how the syllables sound together.
And the silent majority tumbled out of my typewriter in the attic in Washington one night, and I looked at it and I said, that's a pretty good phrase.
To you, the great silent majority.
He hit the sweet spot, the silent majority.
The majority, often silent, disinterested, never says thank you. The silent majority said, yeah, that's okay, that's great, okay, next.
And as soon as he said that, it was like, rainbows pushed through the clouds and the sun shined. And basically the silent majority forevermore would become known as the coalition that Nixon spoke to.
We gave Nixon language that carried him forward to the silent majority and to the role that we saw for him in that election.
The silent center speech that Richard Nixon gave in the spring of 1968 was basically the blueprint for Republican politics for the next 40 years.
We have united our party, but more than that,
this idea that the moral backbone of America are the ordinary, hard-working, middle American families.
The millions of people in the middle of the American political spectrum. The great silent majority. That is the silent center.
A new political alignment was coming into place in which what Nixon would eventually call the silent majority, but what he called in 1968 the silent center, would be the dominant force in American politics.
Buckle down with Nixon, buckle down. We can win with Nixon if we buckle down. We can always fight.
Our series is called This Weekend in 1968. For 40 years, presidential candidates have been trying to claim this supposed great American middle.
Yeah, but lately the conventional wisdom is that there is no harmonious middle, that America is polarized between red and blue. But the New York Times wrote this week that John McCain is reviving that idea of the silent center.
Right. Candidates always move toward the middle in the general election. But with Republicans so unpopular this year, McCain is really counting on capturing the silent center. You can read more about Richard Whalen's life as a Nixon speechwriter in his book, Catch the Falling Flag, A Republican's Challenge to His Party. Rick Perlstein's book is just out, Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America.
Our series, This Weekend in 1968, is produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler, with help from Lila Dobbs. Special thanks to the Pacifica Archives for their archival tape. You can hear the whole series. Just go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Stay tuned for McCain's crystal ball, horse racing's bad leg, and a new way to dispose of the body. Good news, bad news, or no news, next on Weekend America. This is Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. We have come to the part of the show called Good News, Bad News, or No News. We go over some of the week's events and sort out our feelings about those events. If we're lucky, healing happens. Joining us this week, Red State author Nancy French. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Bill.
Also, writer-producer, Hollywood elite, John Ridley. Hi, John.
What is a Red State writer? What is
that
I'm labeling
a compliment
you. Or a pejorative?
Don't interrupt that's me. Not, and essayist, that's... New York intellectual, David Rakoff. Hi, David.
Hello, you forgot sodomite. Hello.
Why can't I be an East Coast intellectual?
You're in Burbank or Glendale or something. Ah. Okay, our first topic. Candidate John McCain this week painted a happy picture of the world at the end of his first term. Iraq is a functioning democracy. America's combat role there has ended. Most of our troops are home. Iran and North Korea have abandoned the bomb. Our economy is growing robustly.
Have I lost any weight?
And John is svelte. Is this picture good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, the thing is, he also did promise to uphold the Constitution. Which is astonishing that would be a newsworthy campaign platform.
Mm.
That a
it is for
president's
him.
Going to uphold the. Well, it's kind of like getting home from the movies and having the babysitter demand double the pay because your children didn't die while they were under her care. It seems like real chutzpah to me.
Others?
It was off-putting to me, so it would be off-putting news. when I heard the speech. He was speaking about the year 2013 as if it had already happened. So, like when he said the Iraq War had been won, Russia and China pressured Iran to give up nuclear bombs. It seemed like it was sprinkled with fairy dust. I just thought it was all very awkward.
It was a very impressive list. I'll give him that.
Yes, it's an extraordinary list. It does have a little bit of the tinfoil hat about it, does it not? It's a little crazy.
Off-putting news. John?
I would say that if you were a Democrat, it's very good news. McCain has, in one speech, he's in effect reversed himself, although he's made very clear that when he said 100-year war, he was being metaphorical.
Right.
So if you were a Democrat, to be able to say, look, this guy is flip-flopping on how long we're going to have a presence in Iraq, that's terrific news. If you're a McCain supporter, I think it's bad, bad news. If you are a Huckabee supporter, it's no news.
Okay, our next topic. 2 weeks ago at the Kentucky Derby, a filly broke her leg and was euthanized. This weekend, we're racing horses again at the Preakness. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
That the Preakness follows the Kentucky Derby?
That we're still racing. We're doing it again this weekend. After all, the hue, not just the hue either, but I want to also mention the cry.
I would, if I could jump back, to me it's no news, Bill. And what part is no news is that every time, you know, animals get a little hurt doing what we expect them to do, all the animal rights people just start jumping up and crying and throwing their wet blankets on the good time the rest of us have.
By the way, a little hurt, I just want to talk about the term a little hurt because...
Yeah.
Because Eight Bells was actually quite hurt.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry that she sprained her ankle. You know what? If you went through the NFL and started euthanizing every guy who had a pulled muscle, a little groin pull.
Wow.
Oh, I hurt my leg. Oh, let's put T.O. down because he hurt. He can't catch this week. Oh, what? Kobe Bryant? He can't play?
Okay.
Well, come on, Kobe. Come in the back room. We got a shot for you, Kobe.
We've left reality at this point.
No, but he has a point because
yeah,
you don't see
you.
These things.
Thank you, Red State writer Nancy French.
you don't see people protesting like NASCAR. You know, like when Dale Earnhardt died, people, they did make some changes in the safety precautions, but you didn't have a committee formed and there wasn't the public outcry. And that was a human.
Nancy makes the point much better than I could. When people die, nobody cares. When the animals, ooh, we got a little bit hurt. Ooh, let's just shut this down. Ooh, let's stop John's betting problems because he can't bet on the sports now.
I see.
I like that dark eruption from the id right at the end. That was nice.
David?
I have to say I agree. It's no news. It's also, you know, if you breed these animals, inbreed them so that they're, you know, as genetically weird and fragile as the Romanovs, and then they, you know, experience some problems, it just doesn't seem like news to me.
Okay, our next topic. There's a new way to dispose of human bodies that uses lye, heat, and pressure to turn your corpse into some dry residue and some brownish syrupy liquid that can be poured down the drain. Does this sound like good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, here's the thing. This is no news for a variety of reasons. First of all, it's unclear whether it's they talk about it being less wasteful or less polluting since it requires heat, 300 degrees worth, significant pressure, and it still leaves you with the same cubic volume of dry stuff as cremains in addition to like a Bosco-like Soylent Green syrup. But the other reason why it's also no news is because every sensational news story that you ever read about the human disposal industry, whenever they're talking about a potential new treatment, what they mean is that they've been doing it for quite some time and that it's leaking out now. So somewhere there's some beautiful funeral parlor by a stream, and if you were to sort of sample the water of the nearby pond, you would find that it was viscous, brownish, and filled with human soup.
So no news, David says. Others?
It's kind of hard to get excited about it, to be honest, because, you know, it's hard to get there. Like, I can go ashes to ashes, dust to dust, but to, like, brown as syrupy residue, it's just, I don't know, intellectually it's hard to feel comfortable with that.
Well, the advocates say it's good news. It eliminates the pollution of crematoriums, doesn't take up space like burial. A Catholic diocese says bad news because this is an undignified way to treat a person's body.
Well, you know, people who talk about the fact that we are running out of land space usually live in New York.
Mm.
If you have an alternative to turning yourself into maple syrup, you come on down to Tennessee and I'll find you a place to get buried. Mm.
Isn't that the new state slogan?
Yes, it is.
I don't think so.
It's a tourist slogan that it's having mixed reviews.
Nancy, I just have trouble wrapping my head around this form of exit. The concept of being liquefied, and then in every sales pitch that I've seen for it, they do mention you can pour it down the drain.
Safely. Yeah.
Bad news.
Well, you guys probably don't hang around many creationist, but sometimes people who are critical of evolution describe it as going from goo to the zoo to you.
Hmm.
So if you liquefied yourself, you'd come full circle and you wouldn't even have to go to the zoo.
Do you think that creationists will be more likely to embrace the liquefying of humanity?
No, I don't think so. I just don't see this brownish syrupy residue as being that attractive.
They need a new word for that. They need a registered trademark term. Yes. For that brownish syrupy residue.
Yeah, that's not working. Clearly, the focus group here is turning thumbs down. That's the news. Panel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Feel free to suggest that new word when you're sending an angry letter about the other thing. Oh, my. John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man. His latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes. Nancy French is the author of A Red State of Mind, How a Catfish Queen Reject Became a Liberty Bell. And David Rakoff is the author of Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Weekend America, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
An organic rice farmer is on the lookout for a bunch of quacks. Coming up on Weekend America. You're listening to Week in America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. This is the show about what's happening this weekend, like in upstate New York, where more than 100 anglers from around the world are gathering to catch carp. Yep, those mud-sucking bottom feeders are the stars of the American Carp Society's regional tournament.
Good for them. Carps are the red-headed stepchildren of the fishing world.
I know, and it doesn't help.
If red-headed stepchildren sucked mud off the bottom of lakes.
That's true. Well, it doesn't help that carp are also breeding so much they're pushing out popular catches like perch and bass. So that's one reason fishing carp is good for the environment. Reporter Julie Grant has the story.
There are lots of sexy fish out there to catch. Rainbow trout, salmon, bluegill, bass. Alan Anderson and his buddies are fishing at West Branch Park along a small lake in Ohio. But what they're catching doesn't get any respect.
There are tons of closet, I call them closet carpers. They don't want to admit that they fish for carp. But when the sun goes down, out they come. And along the banks, along the rivers.
Carp get a bad rap. They root around in the mud for food. You can catch them right off the shore. You don't even need a boat. I've only been at the lake 5 minutes when another angler, Dick Laubscher, gets a bite on his line. He hands the rod to me, a complete novice, to reel it in.
Get a hold of the rod just like this.
Okay.
Now you'll know why we fish for carp after you reel it in.
Oh, get two fingers, the second finger.
The okay. Carp gives a good fight.
Yeah, oh, look at it. Check it out.
Yep. There you go.
We pull it onto the shore, and it's huge, about 10 pounds. Some carp grow up to 60 pounds. They've been known to leap out of the water and break fishermen's arms and noses. We look at my carp a moment. Then something strange happens. They let it go.
We gently put them back in the water. Live for another day.
And that's the problem. Carp are taking over the rivers. Asian carp were brought to the U.S. to eat algae in farming ponds in the South, but they escaped those ponds in the early 1990s during the Mississippi floods.
And they've been gradually working their way northwards ever since.
That's food writer Terrace Gresko. He's written a new book called Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. He says carp are taking over the food supply in rivers and lakes, even eating the eggs of other fish.
They tend to eat everything. They're voracious feeders on plankton.
Gresko says carp eat nearly half their body weight every day. The carp have eaten their way up the Mississippi River. If they get into the Great Lakes, there's concern they won't leave any food for other fish like bass, walleye, and perch. So Gresko has hatched an idea.
One of the avenues that we can look at for dealing with the problem might be to eat the guys.
Carp is common on dinner tables in China. It's used to make gefilte fish for the Jewish Passover meal. Gresko says restaurants need to start creating carp dishes to entice people to try it. He says carp flesh is bland tasting, comparable to tilapia or catfish.
But it can be done in a number of nice ways, you know, with a variety of soy sauces and in marinades. It picks up flavor quite well. So there is potential for it.
But it's been a hard sell. People just don't want to try a fish infamous for eating gunk off the bottom of rivers. The carp fishermen say pollution isn't the fish's fault. People made the waters dirty. Back at the lakeshore, anglers Richie Eldridge and Dick Laubscher defend their much-maligned friends.
They're good-looking fish, and people don't give them enough credit.
Nope.
I mean, they got nice colors on them. I mean, beautiful colors. Look at the golds on them.
They're really pristine-looking. There's nothing wrong with the way they look.
Hey, Dick, do you eat these?
No.
As the carp population grows and pushes out other fish, we might just have to develop a taste for them, whether we like it or not. At West Branch Park in Ohio, I'm Julie Grant for Weekend America.
Keep his head up. There you go. Okay, now you don't have to reel anymore.
I got a
That's
hint.
Good. That's okay.
Just give the carps a sexier name. I mean, nobody was eating slime heads either until they renamed them Orange Ruffy. If you're fishing for some fun this weekend, go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend. In St. Louis, Missouri, and many other American towns, if you were to ask somebody whether he's a wrestling fan, he might ask you, well, which wrestling? Because there's the WWE, WrestleMania, wrestling, Ultimate Fighting, Lucha Libre, and there is an older style of wrestling that's been around in St. Louis since the 40s. This weekend, wrestlers there will square off against each other in the old way. Producer Adam Allington has the story.
Just about a beer bottle's throw from the Mississippi River in St. Louis is a tiny brick building called the South Broadway Athletic Club. It's Saturday night, and the first thing you see when you walk through the door is a tall middle-aged black wrestler in a leather trench coat lifting some poor guy over his head just before the inevitable. The guy issuing the smackdown goes simply by the name Shaft. But this isn't your standard pay-per-view WrestleMania type affair. Shaft's a 50-year-old and works at an automotive parts warehouse.
I'm pretty much of an old-school wrestler.
And when Shaft says old-school, he doesn't mean Hulk Hogan old-school. He's talking about guys like 1959 World Heavyweight Champion Pat O'Connor.
I do the standing toe hold that Pat O'Connor used to do. My two finishing moves is the ankle lock, and the other one is the bulldog off the rope.
Bulldog off the rope? What does that entail?
Basically, all it is grab him by the head, and I run toward the ropes and bounce off the ropes and turn around and slam his head down on the mat.
Got that? He slams their head into the floor. Not exactly Greco-Roman wrestling, but this isn't some WWE knockoff either. Founded in 1904, the South Broadway is one of the places where the idea of spectacle and sport got together, a kind of traveling vaudeville for the working class. And by the 1960s, regional wrestling was huge. Matches at the downtown arena, the Kiel Auditorium, would regularly sell out. Wayne St. Wayne grew up in St. Louis going to those matches.
The smell of beer and cigar smoke reminds me of Kiel Auditorium on Friday night. You'd go into the building and it would gradually fill up, and there was Dick the Bruiser.
Wayne saw these wrestlers as comic book characters coming to life. He eventually became one himself, competing under the name Buddy Frankenstein in the 1980s.
I have never, ever been a sports fan as far as real actual sports, and never will be, but something about wrestling intrigued me with characters and larger-than-life humanoids and hominids. World champion Gene Kaniski from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, the Crusher, the cousin of Dick the Bruiser, Edouard Carpentier, the Flying Frenchman, former world champion.
The second match of the evening is a classic good guy versus bad guy. In the business, they call these heels and babies. A clean-cut blonde wrestler in red, white, and blue tights going by the name Johnny Courageous, up against a dirty fighting hippie in a tie-dyed shirt called Bobby D.
If you get a man in there that's going to do anything he can to win, and he'll choke you, or kick you, or bite you, or anything, the people are going to like him.
Tony Costa is a former wrestler and manager from back in the day. He says wrestling's always been spectacle, but back before steroids and energy drink sponsorships, it still had heart.
When I was wrestling, wrestling was wrestling. And when they had years ago here in St. Louis, they're wrestling at the St. Louis House, wrestling at the Chase, that was wrestling. Today, it's more like a circus in a lot of places.
Costa says wrestling started going downhill when a young promoter from the Northeast, Vince McMahon Jr., formed the World Wrestling Federation, broadcast his matches on cable TV, and effectively destroyed the market for regional wrestling. But the scene didn't completely die out in St. Louis. For the old-school fans, some of the original grit is still there. And the reason? Most of the wrestlers have real lives, just like they do. Alexis Lightfoot isn't just the current Missouri-Illinois ladies champion. She's also a mom.
Well, it's really hard because, you know, I'm a wife, I'm a mom, I'm a wrestler, and you try to tie everything into one, and sometimes, you know, when your three-year-old gets, you know, kind of out of line, you just want to body slam them on the ground.
I think everyone can identify with that sentiment. I mean, who hasn't thought of diving across the conference table to put your boss in a headlock? And maybe that's what the South Broadway is all about. a place where you don't have to be paid $1 million to know a thing or two about a pile driver. For Weekend America, I'm Adam Allington in St. Louis.
Wrestlers are competing this Saturday at the Community Center just across the river in Illinois there. Hitting the mat will be Jeremy and Alexis Lightfoot and Mr. Bibbs and the Lumberjacks. And yes, Moondog Rover will be there. But see, I can tell you that. But trust me, better is to go to our website and see and hear the action. We have a multimedia slideshow with audio, some amazing video and photos at weekendamerica.org.
This is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul with Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Rice has been in the headlines lately. For more than half of the people in the world, rice is a staple of their diet. Cyclones and droughts have hit some of the larger rice-producing countries this year, limiting supply and forcing prices skyward. But rice production is also on the minds of people here closer to home. This weekend in California, rice farmers are in the middle of planting their annual crop. But one family farm in the Sacramento River Valley has to do one thing before they can start planting. They have to deal with wild ducks and their eggs. Reporter Nancy Mullane visited the Lundberg family farm in Richvale. Here's the story.
If you've ever bought a bag of organic rice, odds are it came from one of the fields right here on the Lundberg family farm, the nation's largest producer of organic rice. This time of year, many of their fields are bright purple, thanks to a colorful cover crop called vetch. It helps enrich the soil. The vetch also serves as a perfect nesting ground for wild ducks migrating along the Pacific Flyway. That's just the sort of symbiotic relationship you'd expect on an organic farm, with one hitch. Bryce Lundberg and his family have to plow up these fields before they can plant this year's rice crop, and the eggs haven't hatched yet. Bryce looks out on the next field to plow and points to a red tractor with large metal blades used to churn up the vetch and the dirt.
And that goes through, that'll chew up the eggs or, you know, destroy the eggs.
Most farmers just plow the fields, eggs and all. The Lundbergs have a different approach. While one employee drives a tractor, Bryce and his 18-year-old son ride out in front on ATVs. The idea is to flush out the mother ducks sitting on the nests and collect the eggs before the tractor blades get there.
Oops, right there's one. Let's go see if we can find it. Grab a cart.
Tim Castelong is a longtime employee who's helping with the egg hunt.
You have to be really careful because you can actually step on the nest, you know. So you
eyes down, the three men push the thick grasses aside, searching for the nest.
Yeah, there it is.
Castelong picks up three light blue duck eggs and gently places them in a cardboard egg carton. Over the past 15 years, they've brought more than 30,000 eggs to the local wild bird hatchery.
Inside that egg, it starts with a little tiny heart, and little tiny veins go into the inner lining of the egg. It's the embryo. And then pretty soon it just grows and grows, and eventually it turns into a little duck in there. And it's amazing. It's life, man. It's amazing how that happens.
The Lundberg family has been farming for four generations. The local cafe in their small town of Richvale serves as a mini museum to their evolution as farmers.
Let me just show you the Rogues Gallery.
Here's a picture of my dad.
That's Harlan Lundberg. Before sitting down to lunch with his brother, Homer, he wants to show off photos of his father. Back in the 1930s, Albert Lundberg was farming wheat and corn in Nebraska. But killing the wild grasses and then over-farming the land caused deep erosion, and that helped to lead to the Dust Bowl crisis. His father sold what was left of his farm in Nebraska and moved to California's Sacramento River Valley with his wife and four sons.
Dad coming out of the Dust Bowl and that type of thing, he said, we are going to leave this ground better than we found it. It's not going to be mining of the soil. It's going to be building it up and improving it.
He started by rotating crops. He let fields go fallow every other year to replenish the soil's nutrients and used cover crops in the off season.
I guess he was an ecologist before the people were even using the word. But we got that spirit.
Harlan's older brother, Homer, jumps in.
I don't think what the ordinary farmer's doing can be long-term, because pretty soon the ground won't produce anymore. It'll just be poisoned.
If you want sustainability, you protect the land that grows our food.
Absolutely.
End of sermon.
Harlan and Homer finish their lunch at the cafe. Over in the fields, the next two generations of Lundbergs are busy planting this year's rice crop with an eye out for wild duck eggs. In Richfield, California, I'm Nancy Mullane for Weekend America.
There's this great slideshow of the workers preparing the field for rice, but they're stopping to rescue the duck eggs. Nest at our website, weekendamerica.org.
It's hot there at the Lundberg family farm this weekend. The whole West Coast is seeing record highs. Here is more on the weekend weather with Brendan Noonan.
It's going to be sunny with a high of 84 degrees in Fruta, Colorado, the home of Mike the Headless Chicken Festival. The festival is held in honor of Mike, a chicken who back in 1945 lived for 18 months after his head was removed by a hungry farmer. I, for one, totally don't believe this story. I mean, I've never met a chicken named Mike. South Carolina is hosting the Flush Festival this weekend. I know what you're thinking, another poker event. Actually, the festival celebrates the first flush of buds on tea bushes at the Charleston Tea Plantation. Attendees who pay close attention will be able to see their futures. Everyone else can just sit back and enjoy sunny skies and 70-degree weather. And WARE Camp 2008 is happening at Google headquarters in Mountain View, California this weekend. WARE Camp is an unconference, which means that at the beginning of each day, attendees decide how to spend their time. I have an idea. How about margaritas and naps? It's going to be a clear day with highs in the 80s. Not surprising, since Google announced on Friday that they bought the sun. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
Love the smell of napalm in the morning? Have we got a film festival for you? Stay tuned to Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
With Bill Radke in Los Angeles, I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. Now, Bill, you don't like war movies, do you?
And we were talking about this. Even as a kid, they depressed me.
Well, I didn't think I liked them either until I actually tallied up all the ones I've seen, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. I think it's just more some of the Vietnam War movies and then the recent ones about Iraq. I've avoided a lot of them. There's just too much gore for me.
Right.
But that might be part of the conversation this weekend in Washington, D.C. It's the second annual GI Film Festival, and they're showing a mix of recent feature films, documentaries, and even some of the classics. Larry Seward is a military historian who's going to be speaking on a panel today. today about the 100 greatest war movies. I asked them what makes a good war film.
The same thing that makes a good movie of any genre. It tells a story with a beginning, middle, and end, and has characters with whom you can empathize. The difference in a war movie is the violence that accompanies the stories. If you go back to The Longest Day, which I think is the best war movie, even though its violence had to be muted because of the code office, it still captured the confusion and the violence and the death in Normandy.
So, Larry, what is The Longest Day about? I never saw that film.
All right. The Longest Day is the recreation of D-Day, June 6, 1944, by Daryl Zanuck, primarily focusing on the fighting on Omaha Beach and the bravery of the American troops who had to come off the landing craft in the face of significant German fire from the cliffs overlooking the beaches.
So we have a clip of The Longest Day. Let's listen to that.
You know something? I haven't fired my gun all day. I keep hearing shooting, but every time I get there, everybody's gone.
It's funny, isn't it? He's dead. I'm crippled. You're lost. I suppose it's always like that. I mean, war. I wonder who won.
That's my favorite scene in the movie. Ironically, it is fiction. Even though it's inaccurate, it captures the essence of the day, and it does not change history. You know, the American wonders who won, and that's probably part of the confusion that existed for many days.
You know, one war film that really stands out to me is Patton. You've got George C. Scott in that opening scene stepping up in front of that huge American flag.
Any film that is, to me, a great film must leave something to the culture, whether it's visual, whether it's sound, whether it's music. In the case of Patton, the opening sequence, you know, you always think of it, it is parodied, it is made fun of, but it truly captures the American people, that they love a winner, will not tolerate a loser.
I want you to remember that no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country.
And then, of course, at the very end, Patton goes off in the field and there's a windmill. And people immediately connect Patton to Don Quixote. And the screenwriter told me that absolutely that was the intended image to leave. This great general who also makes a fool of himself is a little bit like Don Quixote, brave, but a little bit crazy. The problem with this is it's in the middle of the Vietnam War, and we are losing.
So what you're saying is that Patton is a World War II film that was released during the Vietnam War?
Right. And so you have the pro-war people saying, where is Patton when we need him? The anti-war people are saying, that's why we are where we are, because he glorifies violence and killing and the need to win. There's a problem there. Filmmaker, once Vietnam became controversial, filmmakers did not want to make movies about the war. There were no heroes. So if they wanted to make a traditional war movie with a great hero, with violence, and with the Americans winning, they had to go back to World War II.
Are there no recent movies that we feel are in the genre of, like, classic war films?
Well, I think Black Hawk Down, even though it has some gratuitous violence, is a very powerful movie. It shows the sacrifices Americans made, the losses they suffered, ultimately for no good reason. But it is a fine movie, and I think it will become a classic.
What is a theme in war films that has stayed constant through the years?
Young, innocent boys are turned into men. And this starts way back in World War I, The Unbeliever. A rich boy supposedly sees Marines watching. He knows World War I is going to be fought, and he joins. He's a dilettante. He's a non-believer. He's an elitist. The Marines turn him into a man. And they also, at the end, give him a girlfriend.
Larry, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Larry Seward is the author of the book Stars and Stripes on the Screen. Today, he's speaking at the GI Film Festival. He's talking about the 100 greatest war films on a panel in Washington, D.C.
Des, what war movie would you put on that list?
You know, I like those with a strong human story, like Life is Beautiful. But when I was a kid, my dad served in Thailand during the Vietnam War, and my brother and I loved The Green Beret. We thought our dad was a hero. You know, I found out in 2005, Roger Ebert panned that movie as one of the most hated films of all time. He said it was heavy-handed. It was a glorification of the Vietnam War. John Wayne actually got full military cooperation from President Johnson to make that film.
You can find out more about the GI Film Festival happening this weekend if you go to our website, weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. This show is produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, and Mark Sanchez, both of whom will be at that Art-A-Whirl gallery tour in Minneapolis this weekend. Millie Jefferson, E. Okobe, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, celebrating his first wedding anniversary this weekend, and Tim Bomba.
Also, Angela Kim, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Phyllis Owens, who's hanging out at a beach in La Jolla this weekend, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, Michael May, David Banks, and John Moe.
Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of it at weekendamerica.org. I'll be planting my first ever heirloom tomatoes this weekend, so wish me luck because I'm going to kill them.
Good luck in the heat.
I'm Bill. Thank you. I'm Bill Redd.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Remember, it's your weekend. Enjoy.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.